stories based on the devotional iconography of the southern border.
There's something miraculous in them. I feel like any time that we undergo an event, if we come out of it somehow changed or altered or smarter or wiser or hit with some kind of epiphany, I feel like that's a miracle. That's a miracle in itself and requires a kind of commemoration in that way. We need to remember those moments because they changed us.
That's playwright and author Octavio Solis. We spoke with him in 2019 about growing up the son of Mexican migrants in El Paso, Texas. His book of stories based on that history is Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. We re-air that interview this week in honor of Hispanic Heritage Month. Then, a new novel from British author Freya Sampson. It's one of those heartwarming but page-turning reads that makes you feel really good.
That's what I want to read at the moment, really. I found, especially in the last couple of years, my reading and watching appetite has changed. I've got much less tolerance for very high tension and high stress in the kind of entertainment I consume. So, yes, I wrote a book that I wanted to read, really.
Freya Sampson's novel is The Lost Ticket. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Octavio Solis is one of America's most prominent Latino playwrights, author of over 20 plays, including Mother Road, currently running at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Solis recently published his first collection of stories, Retablos. They're based on his own life, growing up the son of Mexican migrants in El Paso, Texas. The stories use memory as a muse to talk about his complicated relationship with his father, the Chicano movement that informed his view of politics at an early age, his estrangement from his brother, so like a border wall itself, and how the border is as much myth as reality, replete, as he writes, with gods and monsters, heroes and fallen angels, troubadours and exiles. Living in a home just a mile from the Rio Grande, Solis was a skinny brown kid on the border, growing up among those who live there and those passing through on their way north. From the first terrible self-awareness of racism, to an innocent game of hide-and-seek, to the discovery of a Mexican girl hiding in the cotton fields, Solis reflects on the moments of trauma and transformation that shaped him into a man. Octavio Solis is the author of more than 20 plays and served as a cultural consultant on Pixar's movie Coco. His book Retablos is published by City Lights Press. Octavio Solis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure to be part of this. I'm very happy to speak with you about my book.
It's just a wonderful book, a memoir told in short stories, really. Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, as the subtitle says. Retablos. First, just tell us, what is a retablo?
A retablo is, I think of them as thank you notes to God, kind of thank you notes, postcards to the divine. They're done ex voto, after a vow, signifying an event, usually painted on a plate of tin or a beaten license plate by a naive artist to commemorate an event, a calamity, which required a plea to the divine, to God, to a specific saint, to the Virgen de Guadalupe, to come and save them from that. And when they offer this as a kind of thank you to commemorate the event. It's inscribed very, very briefly with a description of the event And then this this very specific thank you to whichever divine figure came and offered them solace or offered them salvation or some rescue from this calamity. And the calamity can be as immense as someone possibly dying of cancer or a bus crash or something as mundane as a bee sting on the heel or a dog attacking or the village pig dying, for instance, something like that. But I was struck by them because they seem to me to be very early instances of flash fiction with a graphic design on it as well, a graphic picture.
Flash fiction. What is that?
Yes. Yes, flash fiction, a kind of very short, very concise story with a beginning, middle, and end, containing characters, containing a kind of point. It doesn't need to be a moral at the end of it, like a fable, but a story offering a kind of complex view on the human condition. It can be very deeply personal, or it can be quirky and funny and to be appreciated by everyone, usually. But I found these retablos to be very inspiring for me because they sort of seem to be dictating to me the kind of form that these memories that I had should take.
Memories that you say in retablos, memories that verge on the divine. So there is that divine connection in terms of what a retablo is. But why do these memories verge on the divine?
I think it's because there's something miraculous in them. I feel like any time that we undergo an event, if we come out of it somehow changed or altered or smarter or wiser or hit with some kind of epiphany, I feel like that's a miracle. That's a miracle in itself and requires a kind of commemoration in that way. We need to remember those moments, because they changed us and they changed our relationship to the world. And to me, that's really where the divine intersects with the commonplace.
And moments of epiphany can occur in many ways and do occur in many ways in these stories. The one thing that ties them together is that they're almost like stages of the cross in growing up on the border in El Paso in the 1960s and 70s. Tell us a bit about you, your family, how your family came to El Paso. And you were born there, is that right?
Yes, yes. I was born there in 1958. My mother and father came from Mexico. They came from very different areas, different parts, not too far from each other. But my dad's life was essentially rural, agricultural. He came from a small village called Nasas. And my mom came from a distinctly industrialized city named Torreon in northern Mexico. And they had met each other in Torreon when he finally had left the village to find work and just go to school in Torreon. But they lost contact with each other until by happenstance, they happened to run into each other in Ciudad Juarez. There they met, they started courting. He courted my mom, and then at some point they decided to get married. But according to my grandmother, on the condition that they moved to the United States, because my grandmother wanted her grandchildren to be Americans. She insisted that if they get married, they should move to El Paso. So they crossed the border at the bridge, they walked over, and my mom had papers through my grandmother, but my dad didn't. And my dad didn't think that he needed papers. He thought he could live in El Paso and work in Juarez. He walked daily to Juarez to sell advertisements, ad space, ad time to businesses for a particular radio station. And that's what he wanted to do and build his career there, until he met an officer at the border that told him, hey, what are you doing? You can't be doing this. You need to decide where you want to live. You can't live there and work here. You have to make up your mind. Where are you going? So he acted a little bit like like, you know, the Keeper of the Gates, or Sharon, you know, and offered my dad a choice. And he said, well, my family's there, but my work is there. So I'd rather stay with my family. So he made that choice. And it was hard on him because he went from being somebody in Juarez to suddenly becoming a nobody in El Paso. He started being a dishwasher. He didn't know the language. He didn't know the culture. He tried his best. And then he had five children in quick succession. So he had to work very hard to give us the kind of life we needed. So he was an illegal alien for a while, undocumented, until my mom helped him get at least a green card for him to be able to stay and work in this country.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with playwright and author Octavio Solis about his book of stories based on his own life, Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. He grew up in El Paso, Texas. Your relationship with your father is something that you describe in the book in a number of different stories, wonderful stories. Tell us first about your relationship with your dad as you were growing up, and then tell us about when you got your first job in the same place where he worked.
Well, my relationship with my father at the beginning was always a little strained. He was working so hard. He had a lot of stress and a lot of pressures. And like a lot of men who are raising a family too young, he felt caged and troubled. And so he blocked himself off from us sometimes without even knowing that he was doing that. He was a kind and loving dad, but he could also by turns be sullen and violent. But he stayed with us. He stayed by my mom. He did his best for us. And over time, he started to mellow. But I think I carried a lot of resentment in my heart for all those years, all that time. And it took its toll. I think in many of my plays, I'm chiefly a playwright, by the way, in many of my plays, I tried to work out that relationship with the father. Who's the father? And can we go beyond the point where we see him as a monster to find the man? And I didn't realize much about what I didn't understand what he was going through much until I became a father, till I had my daughter. And then things started to change for me, and I started understanding him and started realizing how closed off I had been from him. But Latino families typically have a tough time dealing with the father. The father is often remote and distant and may seem cold, but it's because he's troubled. He's troubled by the choices that he has to contend with, the world he has to contend with in order to put food on our table.
Well, exactly. You know, you're telling, on the one hand, you're telling a story that is universal in many ways. You know, difficult relationships between fathers and sons are in every culture. But in this book, in Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, it's also very much tied to the circumstances that your family was in. So it's very particular to that as well. So tell us, now, you know, your father came from Mexico. He struggled with, you know, his identity as a person here. You grew up as an American citizen because you were born here. Was that part of the tension between the two of you as well?
Well, I wish I could say that were so. I don't think it was as much that, because he quickly... Later in the 80s, he became an American citizen, both he and my mom. My mom had residence alien status until she became a citizen. But with my dad, it was more that I always felt like he yearned to be back in Mexico. Like there was a part of him that still yearned for that old country where he could be, I think, freer, where he could be a person of some standing, or at least have a better, an equal chance. But that started fading over time as he started to love and enjoy the life he had here. Maybe I'm reading too much into him, and I'm sure he can speak for himself. But that's what I sensed from him. And I desperately wanted to be American, and only that. I desperately wanted to shun the things that made me more Mexican, because in my education, all the people of note, all the people of some success were white. And as I studied literature and I decided to become a writer, especially as I got into theater, I started noticing that all the people that we studied ranged from Shakespeare to Moliere to Chekhov to Arthur Miller to Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams and Sam Shepard, but none of them looked like me. So in the end, I felt like I was studying to be a dead white man. In some regard, and so I think the issues were less with him and more with me in terms of identity. I put the gulf between him and me.
I'd like to come back to what you just said, but just to linger a little bit longer on your family. It also reflected a kind of wall that developed between you and your brother as well, and you know, this borders, walls, these are very connected in the reality and the imagination of our country at this point.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, talk about those connections, both the walls within the family, within family members, and the walls that have been increasingly erected on our border and that reflect the national psychology or even psychosis.
Yes, I can't help but see comparisons between the two, between the walls we erect in our household and in our own hearts, and those that are consciously, physically being erected on our borders. And one very early on in our family was erected between my brother and I. We had a huge rift when we were hardly teenagers, when we hardly knew what we were doing, we hardly knew who we were, and we felt so alienated from each other that it got to be easier to not deal, to pretend they weren't there, to not see each other. And that seemed like the only way we could really function in the house. So in one of my retablos, I describe how everywhere we walked, everywhere we passed each other, everywhere we, in whatever room we were in our own home, there was this invisible wall there that prevented us from dealing and coping with each other, from talking with each other. And it was convenient. We could use it because then we could relax and pretend like, you know, like there wasn't anything wrong. But later on, he made an effort to break it down. And this started up being a long cooling off period, I think, a warming period, where we started sort of finally addressing each other, and then I put it in this book. I put that event and the rift between my brother. I put in the story, and who knows? I think I may have inadvertently erected the wall again.
Oh, that's so sad, because I wanted to know what happened.
He congratulated me first on the book, and then I heard that he was very deeply upset by it. But, you know, I kind of felt that I did it out of love. I did it out of love for him. I wrote the book out of love for my parents as well. And I try to attempt to offer these stories with presenting some grace without ignoring the ugliness that happens in all families, but presented with some sort of grace and real love and admiration for everyone in my family. But uh, But, you know, sometimes it's out of my hands. The other thing I felt as I looked through the book is I felt like if there was anyone who was being put under the microscope and who was being exposed, it was me. I was the one who, to whom I think I was really, I don't quite know how to put it, but I think these stories were not about them, as they were more about me. And the transgressions I made, the reparations I have tried to make, and the lessons I've learned from those experiences.
And I think that comes across very strongly in this book. And of course, you know, families, it's different. People have long histories. It's hard. You can't really control how they're going to take your take on things. But I think that certainly comes across to the reader. And there's a very poignant moment in the book where your father owns up to perhaps what he felt even more strongly than you might have felt, what were his failings as a father. And there is a beautiful, you know, note of love and realness there. As describe to us what happened, that incident.
Well, it was the retablo refers to a moment where the gulf is just too wide between my father and me, and he knows it, and he's doing his best to try to come outside and offer some healing. He just doesn't have the equipment for that. He doesn't know how to do that. He doesn't know how to say I'm sorry. And it's chiefly about that. While in their backyard, where there's a small church, there's a church bazaar going on, where they're playing the game of loteria, which is a kind of Mexican bingo, played with pinto beans on these cards with these really archetypal images, and a caller who calls out these images, these names, and these titles of the images on the cards. And there seems to be a kind of a merging between that loteria game and what's going on in the silence between my father and I. And he doesn't know what to say. He doesn't know what to say except that he says the word era cabrón, which says basically I was a jerk. That's all he can say. And he can't even finish his beer. He sets it down. And he goes inside, and it's a long, painful moment between us, and then a long, painful moment afterwards with me alone, just with those words hanging in the air and that beer before me. And I feel like the only thing I can do is take a drink of his beer. And when I do that, I feel like, well, now we're drinking out of the same spigot, so to speak. So I felt like that was in many ways the first step in breaking down the walls between my father and me. It's also, to me, it seemed like the very first inkling of real change in my father. Dramatic change in him. Night and day, he changed. And he's a very, very different man now. But, you know, that's the thing about these stories that I realized in describing events that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago. And that's that we never step into the same river twice. The father I knew then is not the father now, and he's not the same man from day to day. We're always changing. We're always going through changes. If we don't change, then really we may as well be dead. And so that was the realization that sort of hit me when I was working on these retablos, in particular in dealing with stories that involved my father.
Yes. I mean, you talk about how memory is transformed into story through a memoir, that's a transformation. And, you know, as you said, people aren't the same. You don't step in the same river twice. You don't even do that with yourself. I mean, you are a different person now than the boy who was experiencing those things. So, you know, as a playwright, you're also telling stories. What connection do you make in the process of having written this memoir in the form that it is and the plays that you've written? What are the connections between the transformation of memory into story?
Well, one of the things that that I found very useful, there's a tool, because I've never written fiction before. I've only just started branching out of my theater sphere into the world of literature, and with some success, I might add. But the thing that helped me is, because I've never taken a fiction writing class in my life, and though I'm an avid reader and I love prose, the short story form, as well as the fiction form, I felt very ill-equipped to do it, and yet I felt I had these stories. So the tool that I found very useful for me that helped me was the first-person voice. The voice in the first-person present tense voice was very useful for me with Retablos, because in essence, I'm writing monologues. I'm writing monologues for a single character to tell, a single person standing up before a microphone or around a campfire telling stories about himself, in which he plays all the characters and can describe the events from inside as well as from outside. And so I thought, well, that's the theater monologue, the soliloquy is a great and useful tool in the theater, but I think it was my way also into these stories. It really enabled me to delve into them. The other thing that I was going to say about memory is it became my muse. It allowed me to fictionalize what I could not remember. Because I'm writing about events that took place 50 years ago, and even though this very specific event is etched in my mind, every time I revisit it, it changes. It shifts in little ways. I remember new things, but I don't know if I actually remember them or if I invented them. That's how memory works. It's faulty, but in its inaccuracy, it's useful, because then it gives us permission to be a storyteller, to be a writer, for those patches that are blank, we can fill them in with invention, with things that feel like, well, this will be good for the story. This will add to the story. So I gave myself permission to do that and collaborated with this muse, with memory, to help recreate these moments in a way that made them both present and alive, but also made them feel like fiction. Like the ultimate goal is to tell a story and not to describe something historically accurate about myself, because I think that's not as interesting.
Well, that's a wonderful answer. You know, in just a few minutes that we have left, I can't leave without giving some reference and question to our current situation, where the border is a scene of really unimaginable human suffering and cruelty on the part of the U.S. government. So after having read this book, written this book, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, and looking at the situation today, what are some thoughts that you can leave us with?
Well, in the introduction, I wrote that the crap on the border never changes. That there will always be somebody who wants to come here, and there will always be somebody who wants to keep them back there, there being Mexico or wherever. And I said it never changes. It'll always be this way. But actually, I was wrong. It's gotten worse. It's gotten so much worse. And it's become a flashpoint, a national flashpoint. And especially my town of El Paso, where I was born and raised. That situation has become just really dire. And I feel like it's incumbent on me to take a stand. Where before I felt like, just tell more personal stories about myself. That's all that needs to be done. And I don't think of myself as a political writer. I feel now like I can't. We have to take a stand. We have to take a stand before something more before our government does and takes more draconian measures. I can't help but think of Germany at a time when people could have stood up and could have said no to the National Socialist movement that was going on there, and then decided, no, you know what, the economy's good. As long as the economy's good, why should we complain? Yeah, okay, it's unpleasant, but, you know, we're making more money. And I feel like we're almost at that point. And so I feel like we have to speak up. We have to take a stand. And if my book is used as a way to sort of educate people about the situation in the border, I welcome that. Eagerly, I welcome it. I have a play running right now called Mother Road here at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon, that is addressing many of these issues. And I have a new play called Quixote Nuevo, which we produced at California Shakespeare Theater in Berkeley last year, and which is going to be opening in September at Hartford Stage in Connecticut, that also deals with border issues. I have always been writing about the border and never really truly owned it. and yet now it seems like my work is suddenly more relevant than I ever thought it would be because of this. And I wish, in many ways, I wish it weren't. I wish we didn't have this horrible situation to put the spotlight on my work. But it means then that my work can put the spotlight on that issue. Then I feel a lot better about that.
And I think it does precisely because it tells these personal stories within that context, which is what people need to be able to transcend borders, is to understand the common humanity that we all share.
It's all about empathy. It's all about empathy and not seeing people as these foreign bodies or as vermin or as drug dealers and rapists and people that are here simply to get a free ride or to steal your job. It's really a lot. It's really about seeing them as simply people who want a better chance, who just want to be given a better chance to make a life for their families. And yeah, you know what? I can sort of see the point of view about their about fairness. Get in line, you know, do it the legal way. Get in line. But these people have nothing. They come from countries that have persecuted them. They come from extreme poverty. They come from atrocities and from failed governments. And they have nothing. And that's why they're here. And to make them wait in line? What line? And for how long? They don't have jobs. They don't have food. They don't have basic needs. And so they're coming here to America, to this country, because it's that beacon of hope.
And for those who know something about the history, understand also that the conditions of their countries in many ways stem from policies of the United States.
Oh, yes.
So we have an obligation.
Yes, I think people forget that, or I think there's a generation that doesn't even know that the U.S., sponsored, exacerbated, and extended wars in Central America, in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, that basically destroyed those countries and took out their infrastructure. There's nothing there. There's nothing there but poverty and the usurpation by gangs and a government that just is inadequate in providing basic needs and infrastructure for these people. So they come here looking for that chance. Why do they bypass Mexico? Because Mexico doesn't offer that same beacon of hope that this country has always offered. And if we turn off that beacon, I think we cast ourselves in darkness.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Octavio Solis, it has just been really wonderful to talk with you about your wonderful book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Retablos. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Francesca, it's been my pleasure.
That was Octavio Solis talking with Writer's Voice in 2019. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Retablos. Next up, a book about an old man looking for a young woman he met 60 years ago on a London bus and the young people who joined the search. Stay tuned after the break. That was Ozamatli, Cumbia de los Muertos, recorded live on KEXP. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Freya Sampson's two novels involve people helping others and discovering themselves in the process. Her first novel, The Last Library, was about a community coming together to save their local library. Her new novel, The Lost Ticket, brings a group of strangers together to help an old man in his quest to find and thank a young woman he met on a bus who changed his life. When Libby Nichols arrives in London, broken-hearted and with her life in tatters, the first person she meets on the bus is elderly Frank. He tells her about the time in 1962 that he met a girl on the number 88 bus. They made plans for a date at the National Gallery Art Museum, but Frank lost the bus ticket with her number on it. For the past 60 years, he's ridden the same bus trying to find her. Libby decides to help Frank in his quest, enlisting the help of others who have their own burdens to bear. Throughout the twists and turns of The Lost Ticket, readers follow the characters as they meet challenges, forge connections, and discover hidden strengths, both in themselves and in each other. Freya Sampson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Freya Sampson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
The Lost Ticket, you know, in these times of so much turmoil and chaos and tragedy, it is so refreshing to read a novel that just feels really good. I mean, it's not as if things don't happen. You know, there's sadness. There's even then sorrow in this book. There are difficulties. There's conflict. But it is one of those really satisfying, humane reads. And I just want to thank you. I'm so grateful to you for writing this.
Thank you so much. That's very kind. I mean, that's what I want to read at the moment, really. I found, especially in the last couple of years, my reading and watching appetite has changed. I've got much less tolerance for very high tension and high stress in the kind of entertainment I consume. So yes, I wrote a book that I wanted to read, really.
So let's talk about The Lost Ticket. And let's talk about the characters first. Let's start out with Libby. Tell us who she is and what circumstances we find her in as the book opens.
So Libby is a young woman. She's 29 years old. And we meet her at the start of the story as she is literally sort of running from her old life. She's just had a very sort of painful dumping by her long-term boyfriend, which has ended up with her not just leaving the relationship, but also leaving their home and her job because she worked in his business. So when we meet her, she is arriving in London, having fled her old home, and is on the way to her sister's. She has a sort of difficult, complicated relationship with her sister, but desperate times have called for her to go and stay with her sister. So she is with literally suitcases in hand on the way, sort of escaping the devastation of her own personal life.
And her sister is one of these uber perfectionists. I love the way you delineate her character in the book. Tell us a little bit about what her sister is like and the contrast between the two of them.
So I wanted to write about the sort of impact, you know, sibling relationships, but also the sort of role parents can play in shaping the way siblings have their relationships. So these are two young women both, you know, quite successful in their own right, but who have very sort of critical, particularly a very critical mother. And because they've grown up in an environment where they've always been compared to each other, and Libby often compared negatively against her sister Rebecca, their relationship, even when their mother isn't there, is quite a sort of, to begin with, quite a toxic one, where they are constantly comparing themselves to each other. And Rebecca is not very kind to Libby. And I think it's often the way where there's one sibling that sort of always is the one, you know, the sort of eye roll, oh, Freya, of course. I mean, that's so Freya, you know, is always getting things wrong, is always messing up, is sort of the runt of the family. And Libby definitely, at the start of the book, that's her role in the family. No one has very high expectations for her.
Now, you said, oh, Freya, is this something you've experienced in your own life?
But do you know what? Maybe I shouldn't say this. I think in my family, so I think it's often the younger sibling has quite a hard time competing against an older sibling. So actually, I'm the older sibling, and I was quite academic at school. And my younger brother has many talents, but school wasn't particularly one for him. And I think it's hard being that younger sibling who's always compared to the older sibling, especially if the older sibling, you know, in childhood is quite academic. So actually, no, I'm not that. It would be my brother, although I like to think our relationship is nowhere near as toxic as the sisters in this book.
So Libby goes to stay with her sister, and she finds herself on a bus one day, and she meets a man named Frank. Tell us about Frank.
So Frank is a character I have been thinking about for quite a long time. He's 82. He is an actor, or he has been a professional English stage actor for many years, and has had a very successful, you know, acting career in London. But he has had this sort of missing part of his life, really, which is that in his youth, when he was in his early 20s, he met a young woman on this particular London bus, the 88 bus, and had this sort of quite transformative bus ride with her, where not only did his sort of young male attraction kick off for this beautiful young redheaded artist, but also the conversation they had really changed his life. And Frank, when she got off the bus, he wrote down her phone number on his bus ticket, and then he promptly lost it. And Frank has spent the last six decades riding this bus, trying to find her. Initially, I think in the early years, because he hoped for a romantic relationship with her, and he couldn't kind of get this idea of the one that got away out of his head. But actually, as time's gone on, that's changed. And it's become more about, what became more about, wanting to thank her for the profound impact she had on his life. And then I think as he enters the later stages of his life, and it's sort of become a ritual, really. He is, you know, now in his 80s, his life is much smaller than it once was. And he now rides the bus because it's sort of this habit of riding and looking out, trying to find this woman he's been looking for his whole life.
And changed his life. I mean, this is actually a theme that connects, in a way, Frank and Libby. How did she change his life?
So I think sometimes, you know, it's right time, right place, isn't it? Frank, he was in his early 20s when he met her. His parents ran a shop, a sort of, you know, corner shop, a newsagent's grocery store in London. And Frank worked in the shop and was destined to take it over. That was his family, the legacy. And again, he's sort of only child, quite controlling parents. And when he meets this young woman on the bus, she is everything he isn't. She's an independent. She's moved out of her parents' home. She's gone to art school against her parents' wishes. She's living this quite bohemian, independent London life. And Frank is just completely stunned. He's never met anyone like this who has sort of rebelled against their parents and who has just followed their own wishes. And I mean, you know, this is 1962. So for a young woman to kind of leave home and go off to college against her parents' wishes, it's still quite a rebellious act, I mean, much more so than it is nowadays. And Frank is completely stunned by this, and he admits to her his dream of being an actor, which he's never said out loud before. And she sort of encourages him that it's not impossible to chase that dream. It doesn't have to be a dream. And off the back of that conversation, he completely rethinks his life choices. And she also introduces him to the idea of art, which is sort of a bit of a theme in the book. She tells him, because she's an art student, she tells him about the National Gallery, which is a very famous, wonderful art gallery in London. And that sort of introduction opens up to him and what becomes a lifelong love of art.
So this theme of doing what is your dream, your passion, rather than what your family expects of you is also true for Libby.
It is, yes. So Libby also at school loved art. That was her favourite subject. But her parents, her father's a doctor, and they were dead against her going to art school for sort of different reasons than our girl on the bus. But they were unwilling to support her. And, you know, these days it's a different challenge, isn't it? It's often just a financial one. If your parents won't help you, it's very hard to go and study. So instead, she goes to medical school against her desires and is very unhappy there and ends up dropping out, which sort of perpetuates this idea of Libby as the sort of letdown of the family. And she sort of really repressed this enjoyment and pleasure in art and drawing because it was just part of her life that it was sort of too painful for her to think about, because she'd ended up sort of pursuing this failed medical degree. And then she ends up working for her boyfriend in his business, which is something that she doesn't love at all, but she does for him. So yes, there is a definite sort of similarity in the stories of these two women.
Now, another theme I think in this book is difference. Frank is in the early stages of dementia, and there are some other characters, some minor, some a little bit more major, like Dylan and his friend Esme, who has Down syndrome, who I think really follow up on this theme of difference. Is this something that you were conscious of as you were writing this novel?
Yes, it was. I mean, partly because I think if you ride a bus anywhere in any city in the world, and London is obviously a hugely diverse city, you do meet a real range of people. I mean, I think not consciously, but with both this book and my first book, which is called The Last Chance Library, set in a library, I'm drawn to spaces where all of humanity comes. There aren't many places in our world where everyone mixes, you know, irrelevant of racial background or sort of financial setup. I mean, everybody uses libraries and everybody uses buses, maybe not the super, super rich, but these are spaces, very democratic spaces, really, that we all use. And I think I have been drawn to these spaces where these strangers from very, very different walks of life come together. And I sort of wanted to reflect that in this story, that there are, you know, as you say, different characters who are not perhaps characters that we read all the time in, you know, literature, but who are all sort of part of this story, you know, in the same way the bus is a huge mix. I'd like to think the story is a real mix of characters.
And that's really part of the charm of this book. So Dylan is Frank's carer. Talk a little bit about the dementia aspect of this book. You know, one thing that was interesting to me is, you know, Frank really goes in and out of being, you know, as we say, compos mentis and being confused. And I think that that's characteristic of dementia, although many people are not aware of that necessarily.
Yeah, so I felt like, I mean, so I have personal experience. My grandmother had dementia. And I think often in fiction and in film, when we see dementia represented, we sort of see quite far down the line as sort of what, you know, people who are very, very confused. And actually, for many people, that's not the experiences of early, you know, the early stages of dementia. And so when we meet Frank, he's only really just been diagnosed. And I wanted to sort of write about that early stages when actually for a lot of the time, you know, obviously dementia is hugely different for every person. And for some people, it's very fast onset, but for lots of people, it isn't. And I wanted to write about that phase where actually for much of the time, Frank is very sort of well, but he has these moments. And although actually it's not name referenced in the book, the form of dementia that I gave him is something called Lewy body dementia, which is sort of characterized by these periods of not losing consciousness, but sort of zoning out, I suppose, sort of these states where they kind of lose a sense of the world for a period of, you know, often quite a short period of time. So, you know, for Frank, really, that's his main symptom at the beginning, as well as some confusion. But of course, he knows, although he's unwilling to admit it to start with, that things are going to get worse, that dementia inevitably, you know, slow progresses. And so for him, I mean, that's sort of part of his ticking clock, really, of trying to find this girl he's been looking for so long, because he knows a point will come where he either won't be physically capable of going out on the bus, or, you know, that he will forget about her, that she will be lost in his dementia.
Right. So that lends urgency to the search to find the girl on bus 88, a search that Libby joins him on and ropes other people in with, including his carer, Dylan, and Esme gets involved as well. So talk a little bit about this search and the twists and turns that it takes the plot through without, of course, revealing what happens.
So this search was actually inspired by a true story, I mean, of a very different search. But when I was writing my first book, which, as I said, was set in a library, I heard lots of amazing stories about library workers. I mean, you know, they are superheroes. And there was this one story that really stuck with me that sort of, it was during the early stages of the pandemic when lots of library workers were sort of having to go above and beyond to help those most isolated in their community. And there was this one woman who, I think she was 102, who had was having sort of phone calls with the librarian, and the librarian was sort of ringing weekly to check in, to check she was okay. And in one of these conversations, she mentioned that she had spent decades searching for this book that her father had read her as a child. She had very strong memories of this book, but she'd never been able to find it. She couldn't remember the title. And this librarian was just really sort of spurred to action by the story and went out, and not only did they source the book, but then library workers took turns to record themselves reading the story so that this elderly lady could listen to it one more time. And I was hugely struck, not just by this sort of amazing act of kindness on the part of these library workers, but also the person who told me the story told me that actually it had this hugely positive effect on the library workers themselves. In a time that was, you know, very bleak, 2020, they had got real pleasure and joy out of doing this act to help somebody else. And that really sort of stuck in my head, that idea of not just of one person's very long search for something, but also this idea of strangers being sort of motivated to help. Obviously, I knew I didn't want to write about a book, but that was, I sort of took that for Frank's search, although, of course, he's searching for a person, for a woman. But I wanted his story, you know, he tells Libby this story at a time, quite a dark time for her. And she's sort of motivated to help him as something positive to do with her life. And then, as you say, other characters kind of get drawn in to this search, which, you know, they start off, I mean, beyond, she goes beyond the sort of internet search to she creates posters which say, have you seen the girl on the 88 bus, and sort of very briefly outline Frank's story, and they plaster them along the bus route. So the 88 bus route runs from North London to South London through many of the sort of most famous sites of the city. And they sort of paper the route with these posters, which then sort of takes on a life of its own. And there are sort of other things that sort of, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but spring off from that search, from these posters.
And Freya Sampson, in The Lost Ticket, it's very intricately plotted. You throw in a lot of kind of misdirection. You know, it's almost the kind of plot you'd expect in a murder mystery, but of course it's not a murder mystery. But it has that same kind of satisfying leads that go down false trails, and you think something is going to happen, but then actually something else happens. I just would like to ask you about the process of creating that intricate web of plot lines that all kind of tie up satisfyingly at the end.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad you found it satisfying. I would love to have an elegant, I plotted it on a huge, you know, map on my wall story here, but actually it was rather messier than that. I wrote a first draft of this book in sort of late 2020, early 2021. And I wrote it relatively quickly, but it was deeply unsatisfying. And I realized when I finished it that the sort of my own, I guess, anxieties about what was going on in the world had really translated onto the page. And it wasn't at all a sort of the kind of uplifting story that I wanted to write. So I scrapped the entire draft and started again. But because of that, it meant that I'd done quite a lot of the, although I rewrote it, the bones of the story stayed the same. So it meant that I had done quite a lot of the work already, which I think made it easier then when I was rewriting it to sort of put in some of these more twists and turns. But there is a character in the book called Peggy, who was actually a really, really late addition to the story. But now when I read it, I can't imagine how I ever sort of planned the book without her. So it's a long answer to say, actually, sadly, it wasn't beautifully plotted and planned. It was a really organic process that came out of my own kind of emotional journey with the book. But I think hopefully in the end worked out okay.
Well, it definitely did. It is such a satisfying read. It's a real page turner, and I just loved it. The Lost Ticket. Freya Sampson, thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really lovely to talk to you.
Freya Sampson, go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Lost Ticket. Next week on Writer's Voice, the theme is colonialism. We talk with Abdulrazak Gurna, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2021. His novel, newly published in the U.S., is Afterlives. We also speak with fantasy writer R.H. Guang about her novel, Babel. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.